Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, August 17th. Our coverage of the situation in Afghanistan continues. How much displacement is there within the country and at the borders because of the anticipation of what's going to happen to women and girls? Last Friday, the AP reported the UN Refugee Agency says nearly 250,000 Afghans have fled their homes since the end of May amid fears the Taliban would reimpose their strict and ruthless interpretation of Islam, all but eliminating women's rights. 80% of those displaced are women and children, said the AP on Friday. Joining me now to discuss the past, present, and future of women's rights in Afghanistan is Sarah Shays, former NPR reporter who covered the fall of the Taliban in Afghanistan. She went on to advise the topmost levels of the U.S. military, serving as special advisor to two commanders of the international forces in Kabul, and then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen. And she's the author of, most recently, On Corruption in America and What is at Stake. Sarah, it's been a long time. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, it's a pleasure to be speaking to you, except for the context.
Absolutely. Sarah, I'm sure you're seeing in the global headlines today, the Taliban are saying women's rights will be respected and girls can go to school. Do you believe them?
Well, no. But I think our view of all of this, as always, is a little bit complex. And let me say that prior to working for those generals and the admiral that whom you mentioned, I lived in Kandahar. And I think it's important to make that distinction. I lived in the Taliban's former capital of Kandahar, and most of my friends and members of my cooperative, both male and female, were villagers. And so my picture, frankly, of women's rights over the past 20 years has been rather different from a lot of what we're getting on the media. And I'm not trying to denigrate the advances that were made. I'm not trying to say that the future of women under the Taliban is going to be great. What I'm saying is that the life of women over the last 20 years for the great majority of women in Afghanistan was not really what we are hearing. I mean, every woman in my cooperative had been beaten by her husband. Every single one. My male cooperative members were taking their little girls out of school in 2010. Now, I get it, that's Kandahar. But that's kind of what I'm trying to say, is that the picture under the Afghan government that we were supporting was not universally the picture that we're hearing now from a lot of the highly educated, highly socially inserted professional women, basically in Kabul, in Mazar-e-Sharif, and in Herat. That's not representative of how most Afghan women have been living for the last 20 years. That being said, it is no question in my mind that, you know, Afghan women are going back to jail. I mean, at least there was the, you know, theoretically, there was a respect for certain opportunities and rights. Mm-hmm. And that theoretical respect will likely disappear. I'd like to say a couple of other things. One is that I do not foresee Taliban going house to house and committing femicide, you know, like the mass slaughter of females. It's just not in their interests. You know, they're interested in tapping into the international money spigot, right? And they know that, I mean, if the scenes of panic at Kabul airport humiliated us, fine, that's fine with them. But scenes of women, you know, being slung into mass graves would not, you know, it wouldn't serve their interests. And so that's not to say that there won't be individual assassinations of particularly prominent or high-ranking or emblematic women, but I do not foresee, you know, mass casualties among women.
For the past couple of years, the Western media has covered Afghan women as an invaluable part of the nation's rebuilding. How much do you think that was actually the case in terms of women in leadership, politically, women in leadership in business, et cetera, in the 20 years of American presence, maybe even just in the major cities?
I mean, that's the point. I think it's a great way of framing that question. I think that that's a Kabul story, but it's not really, you know, what I witnessed. I would say there were teachers, there was medical staff, and that's very problematic. The future of those women. But I do think the picture that we're getting is heavily influenced by where most reporters are reporting from or have been reporting from, particularly in the last couple of years.
So how does this analysis inform the choices that you think face the Biden administration now with respect to Afghan women and girls?
Brian, I'm not sure I have the words to make any suggestions to the Biden administration. You know, I mean, I just, after the tone that we heard last night, it's one thing to refuse to admit that anything in the way you conducted U.S. policy was wrong. But the tone of contempt for Afghans that came across last night, I think says it all.
When you say last night, you mean in the president's speech?
That's correct.
Let me play one clip, and you tell me if this is what you're referring to in part.
This did unfold more quickly than we had anticipated. So what's happened? Afghanistan political leaders gave up and fled the country. The Afghan military collapsed, sometime without trying to fight. If anything, the developments of the past week reinforced that ending U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan now was the right decision.
So was his characterization of the Afghans unwilling to fight part of what you were just referring to?
It's the tone of voice, Brian. I mean, yes, the words. But the tone of voice, the contempt in his voice. And I just don't, you know, and then look at this highly vaunted visa process for those who worked even directly for years with, you know, U.S. men and women in uniform. I mean, if you look at the fine print of that program, it's no program. The amount of paperwork, the amount of time that applicants are expected to be able to support themselves in a third country that they're supposed to have gotten themselves to, it was a program in name only, as we're now seeing. And so what you see is people, you know, who knows who was hanging off of those C-17s? Who knows how long they had worked with us? And that was their idea of how to get to a third country, is hang on, you know, to the runners of a C-17 cargo plane. I mean, you know, so I don't hold the Biden administration responsible for, you know, this outcome. I was predicting this kind of outcome by 2010. But I don't hold out hope for much constructive behavior, including toward Afghan women and girls, on the part of the Biden administration. And I think it's important to remember that many of these officials were also part of the Obama administration. We're really, insofar as foreign policy is concerned, we're looking at, you know, Obama III. So these are people who were responsible for 8 years of the 20-year story. And I'm both disappointed and ashamed.
Namina in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC with Sarah Shays. Hi, Namina.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. I am so upset because I have a friend whose father was in Happy Kabir with me. I'm so really upset that when Robin mentioned that they just take the Quran and put it on their faces, right away she called me. She was crying on the phone. And I go, you know what, I'm going to call. Oh, I can't believe that. Sorry.
That's okay.
You know, and what I'm saying that I'm a parent. I have a child. These people helped the West, more so the United States of America. There are people dying. There are wives, children, especially children. It makes me weep. Because if I turn my back and they say, my daughter died, I don't know what I will do. You know, so we, God give us children to have empathy, to be kind. Through their eyes, we see good. Let's don't bring religion into it. Let's think about these mothers. Wherever there is war in this world, it's always mothers and children, mothers and children. This man is dead. This woman is here. She's displaced. She doesn't know where her mother and her rest of her family is. And we have to leave religion out of this. We have to feel for other people. When America is killing black bodies, nobody's talking about their religion. Nobody's calling them terrorists. Nobody's calling them monsters. And the leaders are supposed to stop blaming each other. Do not blame Obama. Do not blame Biden. Nobody's blaming Trump. People have to come together. That's why they're leaders, so they can make this work for the good. It's not for the men who went and sacrificed their lives for the so-called West and the United States. At least for the wives and the children. Wherever America goes, America creates chaos. And they leave the chaos, and then they come, they start blaming everybody else. They start blaming the people. That's what they did with Osama bin Laden. They called him to fight whatever what they wanted to fight for them. And then they just left him, and this man turned against them. America has to stop. America has children. America has family. We have to leave religion out of it and have empathy as parents, as human beings. We are human beings. That's all I call to say for Robin to sit down. They have to look in between their hearts and say, you know what, these are human beings. These are children of God, just like you. What if it happened to their family? What would they do? They have to stop blaming. These leaders have to stop blaming themselves, Brian. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I am just an emotional parent.
Thank you very much for your call, and call us again. Sarah, any reaction to any of that?
She's right. You know, and yes, Trump too. Of course, Trump too. And I just am stunned. That's why I mentioned the tone, President Biden's tone.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say something else, Brian, that will be hard for us to take and may take me a minute or two to convey. But, you know, why should Americans care, right? Someone asked me that recently. Not that they thought that, but they were saying that most Americans are not as tuned into this as many people in the media and many vets who have been over there, and all the civilians who've been over there, and things like that, people who've been connected personally, that, you know, much of the American population is concerned with COVID, it's concerned with, you know, our own political chaos, with the economic situation that is hard to fathom. And here's my answer. Afghanistan is a mirror of us. And I think in a way that's what our caller was saying. I didn't quite hear her name. That, you know, if we talk about a feckless Afghan government that really spent a lot of time enriching itself rather than conducting itself in the interests of its own people, and I've got plenty to say about that, and not just the government, but its cronies, you know, that were reaping a lot of the contracts and a lot of the development contracts, and the Speaker of Parliament, who, you know, is a multimillionaire because of the fuel and security contracts that he had with the U.S. military in Bagram. You know, I have to say, well, you know, and we might talk about, well, that's a fragile or a failing or a failed government. We've heard a lot about failed states out there in the developing world, right? And I had reason to say, as I was looking at a number of those countries, including Afghanistan, that, you know, yeah, these governments or states are failing at being states, but the networks that run them are incredibly sophisticated and successful in achieving their own objective, which is personal enrichment. Well, let's take a look at us. I'm speaking to you from Washington, D.C. In the last 20 years, there is, you know, like another Washington, D.C., a donut that has sprung up around the capital city that are these McMansions. I mean, it's just obscene. Bought with, you know, the lavish contracts, you know, that grew out of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And so there are a lot of people. And then you can, let's throw in the banking sector while we're at it, you know? Wow. I mean, and so you have a lot of people who are very highly remunerated for supposedly knowing how to run government policy. And their policies, be it the Great Recession, or be it the Great Recession, or be it Iraq, or be it Afghanistan, how well, or be it how we've handled COVID under the Trump administration.
Right.
Right? So what I'm saying is, don't we look a little bit like a failed state with a network of elites that have been feeding off of this while their own policies have been spectacularly damaging?
Let me play one clip from 2001 and get your reaction to it, and then we're out of time. Because after 9/11 that year, the narrative from the White House went very quickly from we have to capture Osama bin Laden to also incorporate we have to liberate the women of Afghanistan. So here's 30 seconds of a speech that First Lady Laura Bush gave on November 17th, 2001.
Civilized people throughout the world are speaking out in horror, not only because our hearts break for the women and children in Afghanistan, but also because in Afghanistan, we see the world the terrorist would like to impose on the rest of us. We will be especially thankful for all the blessings of American life. I hope Americans will join our family in working to ensure that dignity and opportunity will be secured for all the women and children of Afghanistan.
How does that sound to you with 20 years of history besides quaint? I mean, the idea that, you know, seems to be implied that Muslim cultures in general oppress women, not just the Taliban, or at least that's kind of the way it's landed, I think, with a backlash.
You know, there's so much in that statement. I don't think it was ever the Taliban's intention to spread their rule around the world. I don't think Osama bin Laden wanted to impose an Islamic emirate in the United States of America. That was not their objective. And so that premise is ridiculous. The next premise is that we're sort of going to liberate the women and girls. We want dignity for women and girls. What does that entail? Like, you don't just liberate, you know, a bunch of people who have lived under, you know, Taliban rule and then 20 years of war prior to that. I mean, that's what we've seen. This, oh, let's topple the regime and then suddenly liberty will sprout, you know? It's ridiculous. And so if that was at all an objective, and it had to be. Once you topple a government, you own the result. We learned that in Japan. We learned that in Europe after World War II. We learned that in Korea. We still have troops in Japan, in Korea, and in Europe. And suddenly we have to take the last 5,000 U.S. troops out of Kabul. It's absolutely crucial that they come back in this instant. I mean, you know, and so if you look, if you even compare how much careful focus there was on rebuilding structures of democratic governance in Europe, for example, which was a recently democratic region, we didn't do that in Afghanistan. We never focused on holding or helping the Afghan people hold their own government to account. Instead, what we did was pat their government on the back whenever they shot some Talibs and never called them on their wholesale looting and extortion of the Afghan population. And I was in there. I worked for two commanders of the, at the end of the decade I worked in and on Afghanistan, I worked for the two commanders of the international troops in Kabul, and then I worked for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So I was in on the interagency policy process when we decided explicitly we were not going to address Afghan corruption, let alone even addressing our own role in enabling, reinforcing, and almost enforcing it. And so I just think, again, the level of self-delusion, not only, again, about what we were doing in Afghanistan and how our presence was experienced by Afghans, but frankly, the level of self-delusion that we entertained and continue to entertain about who was the America that was doing that. Who are we? What kind of American democracy were we supposedly bringing and actually bringing? And frankly, as I said, it's a hall of mirrors here. And if we don't have the courage to look at our own reflection that is presented to us by the current events in Afghanistan, I predict that you will see scenes like those at the Kabul airport before too many years have passed here in America.
Wow. Sarah Shays, former NPR reporter who covered the fall of the Taliban in Afghanistan. She went on to advise the topmost levels of the U.S. military. Her latest book is on corruption in America and what is at stake. Sarah, thank you so much. Very bracing.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.